Hi folks, and thanks for listening to this Tortoise Shack podcast. You know what I'm about to say, but please hear me out. The Tortoise Shack relies entirely on you to pay it forward and keep it free for everyone. The couple of quid you throw us carves out that bit of space we need to be able to continue to have conversations like the one you're about to listen to. It's really simple. All you got to do is click the link that's at the top of the podcast you're listening to right now. It says patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Have a look around and see if there's a level that suits your budget. It's not a one-way street. You get a ton of additional content, including podcasts in the last couple of days with Fred Logue on the government's planning and development bill, which has generously been described as anti-democratic, and that's saying something. There's also a great chat with our friend and co-host of Shrapnel, Sam McElwain, that's there right now. And Rory sat down with economist Kieran Nugent to talk about the generation inequality wealth gap, and no doubt is contributing to large parts of the friction in our society. And that's just the last 36 hours. So one more time, patreon.com/tortoiseshack. I'm shutting up now. Enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber podcast. My name is Tony Groves, and Martin, we love having these conversations because it actually gets you thinking beyond kind of, you know, Ashburn.
Oh God, no, I think beyond Ireland all the time. I could be so far beyond Ireland all the time.
You just want to be out of Ireland.
Yeah, I do. I so do. Give me a nice little villa on the quiet side of Ibiza and you'll never hear another peep from me ever.
Majorca.
No, it has to be on the quiet side of Ibiza so I can go party if I want, have a nice quiet afternoon if I want. That's what I need.
Imagine, I think prices start from about 2 million quid. So
about 5 million, Tony. I've checked it out. About 5 million. You know, I don't want to go cheap on this. If you're going to do this, you might as well have your own pool, your own little grounds. You know, what's the point in cheaping out on this?
And in fairness, folks, if any of you are listening and you happen to be billionaires, you know, send it his way because he'll only need it for a few years.
Ten years max. Listen, that's just give me 10 years. I'll sign a contract for 10 years. I will.
If you look right now on the screen, his expiration date is 2027, so you're all good. Anyway, on the horrible, horrible, horrible conversation to open this, we are delighted to be rejoined on the podcast by our friend in Latin America, journalist with El País, Nicolas de Leal. Nicolas, it's great to see you. It's good to see your smile. How are you keeping?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm good. Thanks for having me back. It's great to be here.
Oh, no, we love these conversations with you, and we always have great kind of whistle stop tours of what's going on. But I feel like we should start with the
change. Hold on, we have to ask: quiet side of Ibiza or not? Where would you go for the loud side or the quiet side of Ibiza?
I'm on your team, quiet side.
Yeah. And then you can just dip into it. Now we can start the conversation.
Okay. Now I can ask, on the crazy side with the guy with the chainsaw, how is Argentina? How is Milei? Because all of the libertarians are absolutely delighted with him because he's done so many wonderful things that he's got a budget surplus and everything is great now. And I believe everybody in Argentina is actually much wealthier already since he took over. That's true, isn't it?
Some of it. he has deployed his chainsaw and the effects have started to be felt. But he hasn't really been able to do as much as he wanted to. Probably a good thing, but it also bodes for quite a lot of instability in the coming months or even years, just because of how things might pan out. When he got in office, he looked to get a new reform package through Congress in like extraordinary sessions during the Argentinian summer, so the Congress wasn't convened, and he did some extraordinary sessions to try and get this package of 644 laws that included, you know, political reforms that gave him a lot of executive power to make new laws and make new reforms. So really, autocratic reforms there that fell by the wayside very quickly. Thankfully. Yeah. Also, protest control, so bringing a heavy hand on foreseeable protests that would come, to something like authorizing the reselling of sports tickets. So a very comprehensive package. But he didn't manage to get it through. By the time it was voted on, very early in February, he did get about half of it through, with support from different parties, because he himself, his party, only has 38 seats of 257. So he can't really do things without the support of some allies, but even also some opposition. So he will have to compromise if he wants to get things done through Congress. And that seems to be going to be very difficult, because as these negotiations were happening, the unions, which are very strong in Argentina, not very popular, but very strong, have already started some strikes.
Not just strikes, Nicholas. There's been thousands of them out on the streets. Like we haven't seen, like, if you could imagine in an Irish context that there's maybe 16 unions, 15 of those 16 are out on the streets. Like, it's not just, you know, it's pretty much across the board that they have actually, they have gone out and protested against him, and he's trying to crack down on these, even the right to protest.
Yeah, that's probably one of the tensions that seems that could be the worst in the coming months or during the whole time in power for Milei in the next 4 years, because the unions are really going, you know, head to head against him. So that is worrying, because his rhetoric has a pretty authoritarian stamp on it, and they have already approved some repressive laws. So yeah, that, you know, mass arrests, that sort of thing could happen. I mean, it hasn't happened. All the protests have been, you know, peaceful, very little like trouble. But as time goes by, I would say that is a very big possibility of that we will see that sort of street violence. But yeah, it hasn't got to that point yet.
Can I make 2 points? Because people are going to say to me, Tony, you can't be so negative on the guy. There have seen a fall in rent, in rents, because he's, you know, he's ripped up some of the rental agreements that were forcing people into certain rental agreements. But we've also seen a huge spike in soup kitchens, so because people are so hungry that they are now queuing for more food. So it really is, it is narco-capitalism, is it? Anarcho-capitalism, maybe.
Well, that's what he proposes. I mean, in his 644 laws, there were stuff like, abolishing the central bank, you know, very drastic things that are not going to happen, you know, in the real world. He can't pursue, and he won't be able to get through some of the more drastic things like this, or like the dollarization of the economy, which is something that he was running on very, very strongly. But I mean, in reality, the probability of that happening in the next 4 years is minimum, because it's so complicated to do. Argentina doesn't have a reserve of dollars to back it up. So just in macroeconomic terms and really in technical terms, which I'm not an expert in, but I've sort of understood, it's like it's not going to happen. But what he has done already with the powers that he does have, that he doesn't have to go through Congress, is, for example, as you said, no, for the first time since 2012, in January, the Argentinian government had a budget surplus. So that's a big deal, you know, for 12 years, it's the first time. But how did he achieve that? Well, with 80% cuts in public spending for infrastructure, 60% cuts for food subsidies, rent subsidies, and this sort of thing, 30% cuts in pensions. So that has made poverty reach 60%, so an increase of almost 20% in about 2 months, about 20% in about 2 months since he's been in power. That's also been affected not only by the cuts, but because he devalued the Argentinian pesos by 50% almost the day after he came in power. And that that contributed to a 50% increase in inflation within the first month. So people literally just got poorer. Like that. And, you know, Argentina now has the highest inflation rate in the world, which is at 254% annual. So the thing is, there is still a big portion of the population that are willing to say, all right, it's going to, or understand or believe him when he says it's going to get worse before it gets better. And this is sort of the evidence of that. So he does have some time before, I think, you know, the majority of people turn on him. I'm pretty sure there must be already some people that are regretting their choice.
There must be some buyer regret at the moment already, Nicholas, but are the groups that are generally supporting him, are they the ones who are affected by the draconian cuts?
Everyone's affected by the draconian cuts. I mean, there is another element here. He's cut funding to the different provinces quite drastically. And that has now created a big confrontation between governors of some provinces, most provinces, and the central government, because they're complaining that they're not getting the money they need to, you know, pay for their own services and pay for their own salaries. And that has made a big confrontation even with some of the governments from parties that supported him, including one, you know, a big one that is a province in the Patagonia, which is that's an oil producing province, and the governor of that province, threatened Milei with a cutting supply of oil,
and Milei called this extortion. And he's literally going to battle with people who have their hands on the pumps that actually power your economy. So I don't want to waste too much time on him, but I just do think you're right to point out that everybody's taking the hit, but that increase in poverty is incredible. And like, as I said, what I've heard is the growth in people going to soup kitchens and looking for food is extraordinary, and I'd be wary.
The saddest part of that is that the need for soup kitchens or food banks has increased, but these depended largely on benefits from the government. So the government would give them, you know, the food that they would prepare later in the day, and with all the cuts, that food has also stopped coming. So it's to an extent that the need for soup kitchens and food banks has increased, but the supply has decreased. So it's pretty dire situation for a lot of people. But also, as I said, I think still at this moment, he probably still has the support he got when he was elected. He's got that little bit of a honeymoon period, and that hasn't.
Oh, they loved him. They loved him in Davos. The libertarians loved him in Davos. They thought he was amazing.
That's the thing, as well. He has renegotiated with the IMF. They've dropped a load of cash for him. Blinken went to Well, he went to Rio to meet with the G20. Then he went to Argentina as well and met with Milei, and he was quite positive. I mean, the US don't want to like get too involved. So I think Blinken was very diplomatic.
Yeah, but there's a lot of debt there, Nicholas, as you know. There's a huge debt dependency. And this is, I mean, let's not be fools about this, but he also makes for good headlines. We will move on, but I just find the whole thing kind of disturbing, whereby, you know, as I said, there's this libertarian right that are looking at what he's doing, and they're more or less saying, oh, well, if, you know, many of you will die, as Lord Farquaad will say, you know, many of you will die, but that's a risk I'm willing to take. Or what was the old expression? I'm willing to fight to the last drop of your blood. And he very much strikes me as that kind of guy. And that's a terrifying prospect. Just very quickly, also, the West has woken up to Bukele in the last little while. He's also a darling of the right now, as we build towards this year of elections. He's lecturing the BBC and the UK on political policing and it must be interesting to sit there and watch what was a crypto bro now emerging as a guy who, like, he looks like he belongs at a tech conference, but he wants everybody to think that he's actually a serious mover and shaker, and much of the right wing media are also adopting him now.
Yeah, I mean, in Latin America, there's obviously a very big appetite for this sort of heavy hand security ideology, let's say, because a lot of the population's main issue is security, no? And in El Salvador in particular, the case was dire, you know? And so we can sit here from the outside and see how terrible that is. You know, mass detentions. He's incarcerated about 1% of the population of a small country. It's a lot of people who have been sent to jail. But his approval ratings in the country are above 90%. You know, it is crazy. And I can't sit here and say, all 90% of Salvadorans, you know, are bloodthirsty right wingers, you know, because it's not like that. It's people that weren't that for you know, the best part of a decade had been, you know, absolutely hostage to a pair of gangs that, you know, didn't even let them go out of their houses. You know, if you had a teenage daughter, you didn't let her out of the house because she would get, probably, you know, a very, very high chance of her like getting raped on the street. Your teenage kids were going to get recruited, and if they didn't get recruited, they were going to get killed. You know, the situation was dire, and now people can go out of the street. You know, businesses can function. You know, they're not extorted every single day with the threat of death. So, you know, people see that as a price to pay. These mass detentions within that 1% of the population that has been thrown in prison in absolutely terrible conditions with no proper judicial process, mass judicial process where, like, you know, 50 people get sentenced to 40 years in 20 minutes. Stuff like that, and included within that, a lot of innocent people have been thrown into jail. A lot of innocent people have been, you know, starved to death in jail. The conditions are terrible. But again, the public sentiment is very, very positive. I think, though, that peak has been reached, because now he's building this absolutely authoritarian regime where he's got all the power. Corruption scandals and evidence, I think, are inevitably going to start appearing in the next few years, and it looks very likely like he's building a dictatorship, and those approval ratings will very likely start falling once people get accustomed to life again, to normal life again, not having the gangs there. And, you know, economic problems become the main problem and security starts to go down as the main problem. But the issue is the example that he sets for the rest of the continent, because obviously everyone sees it, no? So there is a very big appetite for that in different societies or in different countries. You know, from Chile, where insecurity has worsened a lot, taking into account that the southern cone, Argentina and Chile, are a lot safer than you know, Central America, basically, which is a far more dangerous place. But perception wise, Chile has had a dramatic increase in, you know, crime. So there's a very, very, very big appetite for a very heavy hand. So it's very possible that in the next Chilean elections, which I'm not too sure when they are, but those aren't this year. They're not part of this year's package. But when they do come, that you know, a far right, heavy handed candidate will win.
More good news. Sorry, Martin. Go ahead.
He is to the extreme. I mean, he is disappearing people at the moment. I mean, they're going into a prison system and disappearing.
Yeah, and innocent people. That has happened. But again, I mean, more than one. You know, many news outlets have given these stories of, you know, they interview a mother who says, you know, my child, he was 16, he was plucked from the street, thrown in jail. I haven't seen him since, you know, and it's been 2 years. I don't even know if he's alive, but I voted for Bukele.
There's echoes of Pinochet there, you know, there just is echoes of Pinochet there.
Yes, but I think there is the, I mean, Bukele, especially in the first elections, these elections were absolutely rigged anyway. I mean, he does have that approval rating, but the elections were rigged, like the opposition is non-existent. But in the first elections, he did win fair and square. You can't say that he didn't. He won fair and square. And in this one, I mean, the re-election is goes against the Salvadoran constitution. So he is literally building a dictatorship. But Pinochet, you know, he got in through a coup, and although he obviously had approval ratings as time went by.
So did Saddam, Nicholas. So did Saddam Hussein, you know?
Yeah.
Look, I want to move on. There's a lot to try and get through, and I really appreciate the, like, listeners need to understand, Nicholas gives us the full breadth of Latin and South America from where he's sitting now in Mexico City, I believe, Nicholas, and I can hear in the background, it's fairly lively out there right now. It
is always like that. I'm sure in previous episodes, people have heard the streets of Mexico City, which are never quiet,
and this is early morning for you, so it's already hopping. But can I go then to very quickly to, before we get to Mexico and maybe the US, I want to mention Gaza before we move on. Lula has continued to be the number one spokesperson to the fore on in terms of speaking for the rights of Palestinian people. Obviously, it's complicated in South America, Latin America, because of, you know, the Israeli community and the Palestinian diaspora, all of these diasporas that exist. But Lula has continued to speak out. And I don't know, he hasn't exactly gotten universal support for it either within Brazil. It's quite split on that as well, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it doesn't have a massive impact on internal politics in Brazil, to be honest. I mean, it does have a little bit of impact, especially like with some economic sectors and, as you said, some social groups. But it's not so much an issue, I think, there. I mean, to be honest, for Latin America, Gaza does seem a bit far away. And it's not something that a lot of people, a lot of, you know, governments are not that they're disinterested in, but they feel like they have nothing to say there, you know, that I can say that of, you know, I don't know, Peru, you know, they have their own issues. That being said, Brazil is a heavyweight. It's one of the biggest economies in the world. And Lula has, since he got in power a year ago, really worked his diplomatic muscle to get Brazil back on the world stage as an important actor after, you know, the Bolsonaro year.
But he did the same, Nicholas. I want to push him because he did the same. He spoke about Ukraine and the need for, you know, dialogue, the need for third party dialogue, the need for, if you can't negotiate, let's have other people negotiate in other areas, in other jurisdictions. And he pushed himself forward. And now he's doing this in terms of Gaza. So that absolutely moves Brazil up the hierarchy of people who are trying to move things. And what I think is important to understand is a year ago when Lula did this in terms of Ukraine, he was kind of laughed at, as if to say, you know, who does this guy think he is? But Western thinking has come around to his logic now. And as Martin always says, you can't do anything until you stop killing people. You know, we need to stop the killing first of all. And I think that is something to take note of, that his, I'm doing air quotes here, his hard left ideas now are coming more mainstream when it comes to some of these bigger conflicts that we're talking about that are happening in the world.
Yeah, I mean, I think this, especially Gaza, I think with Ukraine, I think he does have geopolitical motives that are stronger because he has ties with Russia through the BRICS, and in fact Brazil is one of the few countries that are trading heavily with Russia, and they are giving them a lot of the possibility of still being in this race, you know, along with India and China.
Can I just for listeners' benefit, just explain again the BRICS, the Brazil, Russia, India, China, and it's a lot bigger than that now. Saudi Arabia has joined and all of these other issues that have happened. And I want to point out as well that there were Irish banks up till a few years ago, before it became a dirty word, this idea of BRICS, they were selling BRICS tracker bonds, invest in the BRICS and, you know, put your $5,000 in and get a minimum return and capital guarantees and blah, 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 blah. So, this idea now, what we call the non-aligned countries, it just turns out they're bloody huge now. And the BRICS have got a lot of economic and political power now. And that's, you know, that's the truth. That's the reality of the real global economy.
Yeah. But I think that I think would be the case with how Lula is moving with Ukraine, mainly. Also, a logic of, you know, waning Western power, Washington going down, and a lot more autonomy from, you know, well, the China, India, Russia, and Brazil does want to be part of that. They're obviously, Lula is very anti-imperialist, but I think his movements in Gaza and regarding Israel do come from a different place, from a moral place, from a moral stance and an ethical regard for him, like, you know, something that goes sort of beyond this strategic thing. So how much effect that will have, I think, is probably less. I mean, Israel called him persona non grata, and so he'll wear that as a badge of honor.
Like the time they called him a communist and he went yes.
But I mean, with that I mean, actually Lula as a leader, as a president in his first term and in this one as well, is he's an absolute pragmatist, you know. He actually is very adept at negotiating with everyone. He has his goals are above his ideology. So his definitely, you know, the goals justify the means. Mm. And that is something that, you know, in his first term, for a lot of people, it meant he was corrupt, you know, the way he did business dealings with the state oil company, and the way different deals were done with different, you know, big economic sectors, because also let's not forget the biggest corruption scandal in Latin America involves a Brazilian construction company during the Lula years, and he was completely aware and, you know, complicit with their quotes just by omission. You know, he knew the way that they worked. Whether there's proof that he himself received, you know, economic benefits for that, it hasn't been proven. And in fact, he was in jail and then taken out because there was no proof. But that still, you know, hangs over him. That being said, I mean, personally, I admire Lula enormously because he was able to reduce poverty enormously, to get people in education, you know. I would say that he's working on that within Brazil and outside. Again, his anti-imperialism is really, I think, the driver of his, you know,
is anti-imperialism, and is feeling that he's against what is still, you know, sort of settler colonialism and modern day imperialism, whether it be financial or whatever it is. But look, bringing us on to where you're sitting, Mexico goes to the polls in June, and you just mentioned corruption. There's a lot of corruption scandals swirling around, and there's a lot of issues in terms of what the pressures are between the Mexico and American border. So you may give us a little bit of an overview, because I think this is going to be really significant on both sides of the border, by the way, because, you know, sadly, immigration we talk about in Ireland now is moving up the order of importance, which is not nice to see. People are more agitated about immigration. But right there where you're sitting, Nicholas, it is a key driver. So just fill us in on a little bit on what's actually happening and how things are shaping up as we head towards the summer elections, which are going to be pivotal.
Yeah. Well, in terms of the elections, before going into the immigration and the relationship with the US and all that, just to explain sort of who's running and all that, we basically have two main candidates. They're both women, so it's going to be for the first time Mexico is going to have a female president, which is a very big deal because Mexico is a very, very sexist country. You know, they're 10 women get killed every day by their partners. So it's probably one of the most violent places for women. So that's not a minor thing that a woman will be president. The most likely one is called Claudia Sheinbaum. She is, you know, to put it very, very in simple terms, like the disciple of López Obrador, who's the current president. They belong to López Obrador's party, which is called Morena. And that's a party that within the last 6 years has gone from literally not existing to absolutely dominating completely the electoral politics of the whole country. They have a majority in the legislative branch, so in the Senate. But they also have a majority of the governors in the country and of local parliaments. So they have absolute control. And the way they've achieved that absolute control is, let's say, a little bit dirty, to say the least. But well, we won't go into that. They've basically just taken over a lot of pre-existing party members from a previous sort of right-wing party, and they've like been adopted by them and now rebranded a sort of left-wing. But let's say that the political spectrum in Mexico is all over the place, so we can't really consider López Obrador and Morena as being like left-wing, despite them self-defining as left-wing and, yes, having a very sort of anti-neoliberal stance, because that is their main discourse. But they're, you know, full. They love austerity, for example. So it's not like they're a traditional left wing. And Mexico is a very particular political scene, so that the political spectrum functions in a very different way here. That being said, the other candidate, she's called Xochitl Galvez. She's running for a coalition, like quite a strange coalition of the two sort of more traditional right-wing parties, which is called the PRI and the PAN, and the traditional left-wing party, which is called the PRD. So basically, it's just the confrontation is between AMLO and his new party and establishment, and the old establishment. Chances are, you know, 70% that Sheinbaum's going to win. It seems almost impossible that she's not, because during the 6 years of AMLO, the economy has performed remarkably well. People have seen their incomes rise in real terms, and also they've had like the minimum wage has increased a little bit, not massively, but it has increased, and so the perception is actually quite good, despite the fact that security is pretty dire in many states. You know, the narco has control of absolute control of various regions of the country, and so it's a very strange thing. But now going into this more recent scandal that has come out in the last few weeks, which is coming from north of the border. So various articles have come out from different media, from I think it was Bellingcat, but also the New York Times, different investigations, all with sources from the DEA.
I feel like I must point out Bellingcat and the New York Times haven't had the best of time recently, but please go ahead. They've had some interesting relationships towards pro-US government lines, but go nonetheless, go ahead.
It's a good point, because that is basically the Mexican, or the official, you know, president's Mexican response, because basically what these articles say, based on these DEA sources, is that there was cartel money poured into AMLO's 2018 campaign, which he won the presidential campaign, and basically what AMLO says is that this is just a strategy to delegitimize him, to destabilize, because he has taken a very confrontative attitude towards American interests in Mexico. And as you said, that is principally immigration. So how does the U.S. use Mexico and Mexican, you know, police forces to curb immigration? In the same way as, you know, the EU does with Turkey or Morocco or Tunisia. It's that same idea of a model. Perhaps a little bit more cooperative here. The Americans, I think, they want, you know, Mexico to adopt them, or to receive some of them. And also, it seems now that instead of, and they want also just to have a more orderly immigration system. So they've negotiated that with Mexico and Guatemala very recently, of having, you know, immigration offices set in Guatemala and in Mexico, just to get people processed before they get to the border. So that's a little bit the idea. But today, for example, both Biden and Trump are at the border, just to show how important the border issue is in the US. So this relationship is going to be, you know, a tug of war between the Mexican government and the American one. And this scandal is just, I think, evidence of how that those negotiations are going to go ahead. and their dirty negotiations, because the DEA in particular, so it's not, and this is also very important, it's not the Biden administration that is doing this. It is the DEA. The DEA as an institution has very, its own interests in Mexico. It has its own interests in the war on drugs. They're absolutely against prohibition, because if there wasn't prohibition, they wouldn't exist, So they want their big budgets and they want their big control. And the way the DEA agents work in Mexico is, has been recorded as to be very corrupt themselves, So it is true that the DEA sources don't automatically mean, reliable sources. Because a lot of people would think that, like an official entity like the DEA would be reliable, and they're not. They're not. That is the reality. So that is going to be very interesting to watch. I think it's almost like a movie. To be honest, this thing.
And we came in talking about, this is the year of elections, and we're going out with a few points that we can see are communal across South America. One, there's a change in status quo going on. You've said that yourself, in a few different countries where the status quo is fighting to stay in power. But the, those coming forward and have generally come from nowhere in the last decade. So the status quo is changing, but it's popular amongst all South American countries to see America as the bad guy. That's a universal. That's
But America is the bad guy.
I'm not denying for a second. I'm just saying it's a perception that we don't have here in the West of America being the bad guy. Well, we do and we don't, but nowhere nearly as strong as it is in South America.
No, I mean, we've had the experience firsthand, I think, beyond even, or on a par with the Middle East, in different ways, but our experience has been probably more protracted. But in many countries, there's been these bloody interventions or funding of far right groups. So we have, suffered American interventionism like no other region. Also because the American official doctrine for 200 years was to act like that in Latin America, with the Monroe Doctrine, which was established in 1820s when Latin America got their independences, was that the US saw it as their backyard. So that allowed them and justified themselves the way they've acted in Latin America. So there is a very widespread sentiment and rejection of the US, but it coexists with the American dream. So it coexists with the aspiration of everyone wanting to go there. It is a little bit of a paradox, but it is just the way the perceptions are.
And Nicholas, even if they don't want to go there, they would like some of that kind of liberal democracy that they talk about. And it's not in the US's interest to have it. Like, I know you mentioned the Arab world. Yesterday we spoke to Nabil Halak, who was born in Lebanon, a Palestinian born in Lebanon, a child of the Nakba, you would say, the first Nakba compared to what's happening now. And he talks about, the Arab Spring. Because certain aspects of the Arab world wanted some of that, some of that liberal democracy, but the US did not want it. And we see it now as it plays out in the Arab world, and how the Arab world has been, it depends upon regimes and strongmen and family links that carry out certain things. And America, as the hegemonic power, still there. And now we see it in as I said, I Mille welcomed to Davos. Everybody thought he was great crack. And then Bukele giving a lecture in the BBC and everybody thinking he's great. And now we're seeing, you know, what's happening now with Mexico. And it is worrying because we're going to have this election in Mexico. And then we have potentially a Trump government coming back. And I'll be quite honest with you. I don't know if it matters all that much whether it's Trump or it's Biden or Biden's surrogate. They're not much better than one another, as we've seen. They're not really that.
I think in Latin America specifically, it would be very different, because precisely as I was saying about the Monroe Doctrine, the Biden administration has officially terminated it 200 years after. So last year they officially said that's over. You know, we recognize the autonomy of Latin American countries. Maybe that's just empty words, but I think there has been a growing respect of the Latin American autonomy, and in fact, that has been something that Mexico, in particular, has worked on. They've worked on having a more horizontal relationship with the U.S. And I think this government has achieved it in a big way, and they've benefited massively also from the economic turbulence since the pandemic. So American production has been moved more to Mexico, away from Asia, mainly China, but also other Asian countries. So they've established, you know, different plants of and industries in Mexico, and that has been managed in a far more horizontal way than it would have been 100 years ago. 100 years ago, these American factories in the U.S. wouldn't have benefited Mexico like the American factories in Mexico are going to benefit Mexico today and tomorrow and the next 10 years. And that has been thanks to that difference in the relationship. And I think that has that's something that the Biden administration has done. And I think Trump, he doesn't go by any of these codes, far more unpredictable. Very possible that they did like each other, AMLO and Trump. Absolutely opposing, you know, you would have thought that they hated each other, but Trump is no ideologue, you know, he's absolutely, it's about the persona.
Yeah.
So
that is the truth.
He won't negotiate things based on ideology or, oh, that country's left wing or that guy is like that. It'll be, you know,
it's like, it's, you know, no one would think that myself and Martin, little rocket man, Martin called Kim Jong-il would be friends. But here we are. He's very right wing authoritarian.
I do have to say, Nicholas, I think that if Trump comes in, he's no respecter of pre-existing. He's no respecter of anything. So I do think he could make it a far more unpredictable playing field to be on with Trump. But thanks for coming on and having this conversation, Nicholas. We've learned a lot in the last 45 minutes. I think we've covered the whole continent. And yeah, it's a year of change ahead. It is a year of change.
Yeah, no, it was a tough 45 minutes to fit in so much in, but I hope you guys thought it was interesting, and I hope
it was, yeah.
Get a good feel for things.
Absolutely. And listen, folks, you got to absolutely. Nicholas gives us his time, and we always enjoy chatting to him. If you didn't hear the sirens and the people in the streets of Mexico City, you're not really living it, because this is the only thing. With the last question, Nicholas, tell us, what's the weather like? Because we had hailstones and snow here today. Tell me, what's it like?
Well, it's very, very sunny.
I don't want to hear anymore. Shut up now. Shut up.
I'll give you the bad news. It's so bad that it hasn't been raining, and there's a volcano not too far away from Mexico City that's spewing ash.
Oh, wow.
So the air quality is at the worst levels it's been in quite a while. So,
well, then we don't feel so bad with our hailstones. Thank you very much.
Exactly. I hope that helps out a little.
Nicholas, I hope you survived the volcanic meltdown. And thank you so much for your time. It's always great to catch up with you. We really appreciate your time. And thanks for your patience with us today. I will admit, folks, we were late getting to the pod this afternoon. So apologies for that. And we will talk to you all very, very soon. Take care. Bye-bye.
Tony and Martin, Martin and Tony, speaking to interesting people only. It's the Echo Chamber Podcast. Subscribe now on Patreon.